Today, the pincer movement. The DFA Daily to the 3rd of July 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one of the latest posts covering finance and prop news with a distinctively Australian flavour and with a little philosophy on the side. Today we look at the latest from the US, with the Fed essentially controlling the markets, while official unemployment is lower. While here the RBA spells out some of the implications of future rates, and there are calls for more, yes, yet more support for the housing sector as prices slide. The AFR, citing Bloomberg, says that according to Bridgewater Associates Rodelio, founder of the world's largest hedge fund, recent central bank actions mean capital markets are no longer free. Today, the economy and the markets are driven by the central banks and the coordination with the central government, he said, speaking at the Bloomberg Global Asset Owners Forum. As a result, capital markets are not free markets allocating resources in traditional ways. The COVID-19 pandemic brought economic activity to a standstill and sent markets spiraling downward in March. The Federal Reserve's unprecedented multi-trillion dollar response eased concerns and helped fuel a sharp recovery in financial markets, even as the US economy continues to struggle. He said that the US now has the worst wealth gap since the 1930s, adding that central banks will need to continue to pump money into the economy. We're going to see central bank balance sheets explode. They have to, because the choice is the sinking ship, he said. And he also said that investors should favour stocks and gold over bonds and cash, because the latter offer a negative rate of return and central banks will print more money. Over the last several months, he has written a series of extensive essays that has called for reforming capitalism so that it benefits everyone. And he also said that the US is in relative decline as China's power rises. Dalio, who counts some Chinese government entities as Bridgewater clients, reiterated his concern about the US's ability to compete with China. China is growing, becoming powerful, playing the game in the best way it knows how. We have a different system. We're playing the game the best way we know how. And my main issue is how well are we playing the game, he said. Mentioning the quality of education as one example, it's a very impressive system, he said, referring to China. They are very smart, wise people with great historical perspectives. Bridgewater's flagship Pure Alpha 2 hedge fund struggled this year, falling 20% through May amid the market chaos caused by the pandemic. The firm got hit by the crisis at the worst possible moment because its portfolios were positioned at the start of the year to benefit from rising markets, he told clients in mid-March. The Westport, Connecticut-based firm manages around $138 billion US, as of the end of April, down from $160 billion US at the start of the year. And the US Labor Department data out overnight showed that non-farm payrolls soared by 4.8 million in June and the unemployment rate fell to 11.1% as the US continued its reopening from the coronavirus pandemic. Economists surveyed by Dow Jones had been expecting a 2.9 million increase and a jobless rate of 12.4%. The report was released a day earlier than usual due to the July 4th holiday. The jobs growth marked a big leap from the 2.7 million in May, which was revised up by 190,000. The June total is easily the largest single-month gain in US history. Today's announcement proves that our economy is roaring back. It's coming back extremely strong, President Donald Trump said in a news conference about an hour after the numbers were released. He pointed specifically to a sharp drop in the unemployment for blacks that fell from 16.8% to 15.4%. These are historic numbers. Just don't mention the rising COVID case count, eh? The numbers capture the move by all 50 states to get activity moving again after the virus seized up much of the US, particularly service-related industries. Wall Street reacted positively to the report. However, because the government survey comes from the middle of the month, it does not account for the suspension or rollbacks in regions hit by a resurgence in coronavirus cases. The 4.8 million rise in non-farm payrolls in June provides further confirmation that the initial economic rebound has been far faster than we and most others anticipated, said Michael Pierce, senior US economist at Capital Economics. But that still leaves employment 9.6% higher than its February level. And with the spread of the virus accelerating again, we expect the recovery from here will be a lot bumpier and job gains far slower on average. Indeed, new jobless claims remained stubbornly high last week, with another 1.427 million Americans filing, above the estimate of 1.38 million, the Labour Department said in a separate report, also on Thursday. Continuing claims actually increased by 59,000 to 19.3 million, highlighting the jobless problem likely exacerbated by the ongoing presence of the virus and its economic impact. This slowdown is going to have an impact, absolutely. How big, it's hard to say, said Steve Blitz, chief US economist at T.S. Lombard. There are a lot of unknowns, and it would be silly on the fiscal side to pull back now on stimulus. Leisure and hospitality again accounted for the biggest jump, as the sector saw a 2.1 million gain, accounting for another 40% of the total growth. Another big contributor to the decline in the jobless rate was a plunge in those on temporary layoff. That fell by 4.8 million in June to 10.6 million after a decrease of 2.7 million in May. The short-term jobless level fell by 1 million to 2.8 million. However, those reporting permanent job losses also jumped, rising by 588,000 to 2.883 million, the highest level in more than 6 years. The labour force participation level saw a sharp bump, rising to 61.5%, which brings it 1.9 percentage points below its February level, a month before the coronavirus pandemic shut down much of the US economy. Jobs were equally balanced at 2.4 million apiece for full and part-time workers, and retail also saw a sizable boost with a gain of 740,000. Education and health services rose 568,000, and manufacturing was up 256,000. Manufacturing looks like it's ready to take off to a level that it's never been at before, Trump said. A lot of that has to do with our trade policy because we're bringing manufacturing back to our country. Personal and laundry services saw another major gain at 264,000, part of an increase in other services that totaled 357,000. Professional and business services gained 306,000, construction was up 158,000, and transport and warehousing saw a 99,000 increase. Citigroup economists say the composition of job gains suggests that hiring will continue to be strong even if June might mark the peak. They said current forecasting models are too dependent on weekly claims data, which are distorted because workers hired part-time can still get benefits. A second consecutive large upside surprise to hiring relative to consensus confirms our view that the reopening rebound would be much more robust than most had expected a couple of months ago, Citi economist Andrew Hollenhorst said in a note. We are particularly encouraged by the composition of hiring, which shows potential for further large gains in manufacturing, construction and healthcare jobs, which are relatively insulated from social distancing. Average hourly earnings fell 1.2% from May as more lower-wage earners returned to their jobs, but we're still up 5% from a year ago, and the average work week slipped by 0.2 hours to 34.5 hours. The headline unemployment rate was understated slightly due to continuing errors at the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Workers who still have jobs but have not been working are being counted as employed, even though they're supposed to be considered unemployed under BLS rules. However, the BLS said that discrepancy declined considerably in June, making the actual unemployment rate only about 1 percentage point higher than the reported level, but an alternative measure of unemployment that includes discouraged workers and the underemployed fell to 18% from 21.2%. Now, back here in Australia, Michael Pascoe, writing in the New Daily, pointed out that in a few careful sentences, the Reserve Bank this week told the federal government not to worry about debt approaching $1 trillion as it tries to minimise the coronavirus recession. There was one caveat. The government has to go for growth, has to keep up the necessary fiscal stimulus to have the economy grow at a higher rate than the interest rate it pays on its borrowings. Of course, he said, RBA Deputy Governor Guy Debelle didn't quite phrase it like that in his speech to the Economic Society of Australia, a speech titled The Reserve Bank's Policy Actions and Balance Sheet. You don't expect the language to be particularly racy and headline-worthy, he said, but that was his clear meaning. So the government ministers and commentators rabbiting on about the need to reduce stimulus, who talk about the federal government's debt as if it was the same as a household debt, all get a fail mark from Dr. DeBell. The RBA has purchased more than $51 billion worth of Australian government and semi-government bonds since the start of the COVID crisis, and is happy to keep purchasing bonds to maintain liquidity and keep hitting its target rate of 0.25% on three-year government bonds. Buying these bonds on the secondary market is printing money, injecting cash into the financial system. A criticism of money printing is the danger that it could cause an outbreak of inflation. Dr. DeBell effectively said, don't be silly. He actually said, while the bond purchases by the RBA increase liquidity in the system, I do not see this posing any risk of generating excessively high inflation in the foreseeable future. Indeed, the opposite seems to be the more likely challenge in the current economic climate. That is, that inflation will remain below the RBA's target. Prime Minister Scott Morrison has repeatedly said the private sector must lead the recovery. Most importantly for our central bank, it doesn't doubt that the government will be able to repay those bonds, said DeBell, nor do I see any issue at all with the capacity of the government to repay the bonds it has issued. Firstly, even with the increased issuance to fund the fiscal stimulus, the stock of government debt relative to the size of the Australian economy remains low. Secondly, the government is borrowing at yields that are very low historically. Importantly, the yields on government debt are considerably below the long-run growth rate of the economy. While ever this remains the case, there are no concerns at all about fiscal sustainability from increased debt issuance. This is because growth in the economy will work to lower government debt as a share of nominal GDP. Basically, the government can grow its way out of debt as a high proportion of GDP. That is what Australia, of course, did after World War II, when our debt was proportionally higher than it is now. With interest rates at unprecedented lows, the government has a low hurdle to clear in keeping growth higher than rates. Dr. DeBell dismissed the possibility of the government withdrawing its fiscal support in September. The feared September cliff, he said, the government was aware that it would indeed be a problem and is working on it. We can only hope, he said, they do. So far, Scott Morrison's post-September policy announcements have been piecemeal and bitsy, given the scale of the problem. Or pure marketing spin, such as his record defence spending announcement that was actually not keeping pace with the bipartisan pledge to spend 2% of GDP on things that go bang. Dr. DeBell said that although there is considerable uncertainty about what lies ahead, it is still quite likely that this decline will have a long-lived impact that will require considerable policy support for quite some time to come. While some of that support is likely to be on the fiscal side, the Reserve Bank will maintain the current policies to keep borrowing costs low and credit available, and stands ready to do more as the circumstances warrant. Translated, he said from RBA speak, the central bank will do its bit, whatever it takes, on the monetary side, but there's a lot of spending to be done by the government too. And Dr. DeBell also had a swipe at those pushing negative interest rates. He said that looking at countries that had used them, it was not entirely clear how effective they'd been, which was a polite way of saying it doesn't work. It was a lack of appetite for borrowing holding business back due to their concern about the outlook for the economy. And another part of his speech, Dr. DeBell pointed to how borrowing costs for businesses and households had fallen in response to the RBA's actions. And as a sidelight, on average, people with existing mortgages are paying about half a percentage point in lazy tax, the difference between what banks are charging them and what banks are offering new customers. Some customers are unable to shop around at present, though, because their weaker financial state makes them poor candidates for a new banking relationship. So anyone in financial trouble is pretty much stuck with the banking relationship and the rates they have. And they have to hope it's a good one. Now, for more on that, watch my recent show that I recorded with Canstar on just that issue. And elsewhere, the federal government is expected to address mounting headwinds in the residential property market with a new round of housing stimulus, according to Chris Nickel, analyst at investment firm Morgan Stanley. Demand-driven weakness in the housing would retrace post-election gains in residential property prices, which have begun to decline over the past few months in response to the economic fallout from the virus. The latest data from property research group CoreLogic revealed that national home values fell 0.7% in June, following a 0.4% decline in May. Home lending growth has also slowed, with the latest lending indicators data from the ABS reporting that the value of home loan approvals slipped 4.8% to $18.5 billion season adjusted in April. That's the sharpest decline since May 2015. The Reserve Bank of Australia's latest financial aggregate data also revealed that housing credit growth slowed to 0.2% for the second consecutive month. Mr. Nickel noted that softness in the housing market would likely persist, with market conditions hinging on the rate of economic recovery. According to Mr. Nickel, fiscal policy developments over the coming months would be critical in determining the housing market outlook, with key relief measures including JobKeeper subsidies and repayment holidays due to expire in September. He said he's expecting the federal government to roll out further stimulus to ease mounting headwinds. We expect policy support to be tapered but not removed, and would expect to see further housing support provided by governments, which would limit the extent of price declines, he said. Treasurer Josh Frydenberg recently revealed that the federal government has held discussions with Australia's largest lenders and the RBA concerning the looming expiry of loan repayment holidays. And according to the latest data from the ABA, banks have deferred repayments on over 700,000 loans, or $211 billion. Over 61% of which are residential mortgages. When asked if the government believed loan deferral periods should be extended, Mr. Frydenberg said that such decisions will be left to the banks. However, Mr. Frydenberg noted the difficulties facing borrowers employed in sectors facing longer-term challenges. We know that with the restrictions coming off across the economy, people are starting to get back to work, and that's vitally important, he said. But there are still some sectors, and obviously the workers in those sectors, who are doing it very tough. And we saw just this week the terrible news out of Qantas with 6,000 people losing their jobs. We're going to continue to see some sectors really struggle as the international borders remain closed and people are affected by that. Morgan Stanley estimates that approximately 20% of borrowers on repayment holidays would default on their debt, triggering a $4.3 billion rise in credit losses across the major banks alone. And in economic news, the latest trade numbers were less flash than anticipated. While Australia's trade surplus remained elevated, imports were down on weaker demand and border closures. So the $8 billion number in May followed a revised $7.8 billion in April. Analysts were expecting a stronger $9 billion. But this was because the ABS adjusted last month's figures down by a cool $1 billion. Relative to the end of 2019, total exports in May were 11.8% lower, while imports collapsed 22.6%. Goods exports decreased by 5.4%, down $1.7 billion in May, and that fall was led by coal export earnings, which slumped by 13.3%, or down $635 million, reflecting lower prices and reduced shipments due to weaker demand. Rural goods exports also moved sharply lower, down 10% or down $0.4 billion, with broad-based weaknesses. Falls were also recorded for manufacturing goods and gold. But service exports bucked the trend, up 1.6%, and goods imports fell by 6.9% or down $1.8 billion. Weaknesses were centered on fuel, down $0.4 billion, on lower prices, and transport equipment, down $1.1 billion. Which was down 32%, reflecting the crash in domestic car sales. The exchange rate was a factor in weaker exports and imports in May, with prices lower due to the stronger currency. The Aussie rallied by 3.4% against the US dollar and 3% on a trade-weighted basis. The balance on the trade in services was $2.29 billion in May, up a little from $2.15 billion in April, and a sharp $2.4 billion improved on a deficit of $0.13 billion last December. The closure of Australia's international borders has grounded international travel, both exports and imports. As to education, exports, while they are down on pre-COVID levels, some international students are still in Australia, providing some support to service exports. Total tourism-related service exports in May, which includes education, was $2.4 billion lower than in December, and tourism imports have stopped altogether and are down by $5.1 billion. This $2.7 billion improvement in net tourism more than fully accounts for the $2.4 billion improvement in the overall trade balance in the trade in services. By comparison, the trade balance for goods has improved by a more modest $0.9 billion over this period to be at $5.7 billion in May. Australia's international trade surplus has on balance been boosted by the net impacts of the pandemic. The surplus climbed to a record high in March, hitting $10.4 billion, and remained elevated over April and May. The key dynamic, imports are trending lower as domestic demand contracts, and due to the closure of Australia's international borders, goods and service exports, while not immune from the global recession, have been more resilient. And finally, I wanted to highlight a couple of media outings this week. I was on ABC Radio talking about NAB's warning of lower returns ahead and how this spills over into the superannuation sector and beyond.
Well, today there was a rare admission from one of the country's top bankers that the days of massive bank profits are over. The boss of the National Australia Bank told shareholders they can't expect to receive returns of 15% on their investments again. But it's not just the NAB's shareholders caught up in this investment malaise. Just about every Australian has been told to get used to a new world of low returns. Here's our business reporter, David Taylor.
For years, it was customers paying for bank decisions designed to reward shareholders. Think fees and higher interest rates. Now, thanks to coronavirus, banking analyst Martin North says just about every stakeholder is worse off.
And I think it's just coming to terms with what's really going on.
National Australia Bank Chief Executive Ross McEwan has declared the days of massive bank profits are over. The NAB has its own problems, a heavier reliance on business banking and a troubled foray into the United Kingdom, but it's also dealing with some broader banking challenges. The central one, of course, is that the basic banking business model of lending money at higher interest rates than what depositors are paid has been badly damaged.
The banks have cut and cut and cut their deposits. They've been doing it for the last two or three years. Even term deposit rates are also extremely low as well now. So really, if you're holding money in the bank, you're not looking at holding it there for the returns, but just because it's there and available.
As Martin North explains, as the NAB tries to find ways of making money, it's bank customers that are paying for it.
By the way, they're also making very high returns on credit cards. Nobody even talks about that. You know, credit card rates are still above 20% for many people. So those rates have not come down at all. So if you're a depositor or you're a cardholder, basically you're supporting the banking system.
Gemma Rasmussen is a spokesperson for interest rate comparison site Mozo. She's told PM that despite interest rates on deposit accounts, term deposits and mortgages coming down, credit cards are remaining stubbornly high.
So since the RBA started cutting rates last year, only 10 or so providers have cut credit card interest rates. So the average big bank credit card interest rate is now around 16.88%, with the highest rate around 24.99%, and the lowest non-introductory credit card interest rate sitting at 7.49%. So it's not really great news for people using credit cards.
Is it fair enough to say that this is the bank hotspot where they are making up the returns that would otherwise have been lost in a low interest rate environment?
Absolutely. So I think the banks know that they can charge these high interest rates and they can get away with it.
But the banks can't rely on credit card rates, charges and fees to make their billions. Ultimately, the bank's profits will fall and shareholders won't reap the sorts of returns they've become used to. We now know this because in an unusually frank admission, the NAB CEO today told Nine newspapers that the days of enjoying an impressive 15% return every year are over. Shane Oliver manages billions of dollars in investments run by AMP Capital. He says anyone with superannuation will be hurt by this, highlighting that most superannuation funds have a sizable exposure to the banking sector.
That a typical Australian superannuation fund might have, say, a 7% exposure to Australian banks, and that can translate to a low return from superannuation funds.
Banking analyst Martin North goes further.
This is a big deal because we really have been relying on the finance sector to prop up the superannuation system and return savings via superannuation or indeed directed to shareholders as well, many of whom are older Australians. So this has a very significant knock-on effect beyond the bank itself.
It's not just Australian workers that are being asked to get used to investment returns well below those enjoyed in the past, certainly below double-digit growth. Coronavirus and the economic crisis that's come with it, Dr. Oliver argues, has changed Australia's investment landscape indefinitely.
Lower interest rates on bank deposits, lower bond yields. Obviously, dividends have been cut, so that reduces the return potential from shares. And at the same time, we've got lower economic growth, obviously in recession at the moment, but the recovery will be relatively constrained. So all of those things do point to more constrained returns. I think the reality is we just have to get used to lower rates of return.
AMP Capital's Shane Oliver, David Taylor with that report.
And I was also featured on SBS World News last night as they highlighted my research on the failed off-the-plan settlements, which was first featured in an AFR article yesterday.
There are fresh warnings for those purchasing off-the-plan apartments. SBS finance editor Ricardo Gonçalves joins me in the studio with more. And Ricardo, buyers have lost millions of dollars during the height of the pandemic.
Janice, off the plan contracts can date back years where buyers lock in a price, pay a deposit and then get a loan from the bank once the building has been built. But new figures show the pandemic is catching up with many. Out of 35,000 off the plan settlements between March and June, more than 3,000 fell over as buyers struggled to get financing for properties that have fallen in value.
It can take years to save a deposit for a property and just months to lose it.
There are risks when someone is buying off the plan because initially they're buying a concept.
And the value of that concept can drop dramatically before it is completed. That's what happened to clients of Alex Sapunas, who also lost their job during the pandemic.
So on top of the valuation risk on their property, now they don't have employment, so they can't get a mortgage.
And they're not alone. New analysis by Digital Finance Analytics shows that nationally, 1 in 10 off-the-plan apartment sales between March and June collapsed. Job losses, weaker demand and oversupply have hit valuations, and it's forced buyers to give up deposits worth an estimated $87.6 million.
When a borrower comes to settle, they discover that, one, their property is worth less than they thought, and two, the banks are being more awkward in terms of making the lending. So quite often, they find it difficult to complete the transaction.
And the proportion of off-the-plan apartments racking up large drops in value at settlement has surged. Over the 3 months to May, around half of those located in Sydney, Melbourne and Perth dropped in value compared to the contract price. Around 40% in Brisbane, and in Adelaide and the ACT, values fell between 20 and 25%.
That sector is coming out of an historic level of construction. Even coming into the beginning of 2020, there were more than 40,000 apartments still under construction across Victoria and more than 50,000 in New South Wales.
And it's the two largest property markets, Sydney and Melbourne, that have been overwhelmingly affected.
A lot of these properties were actually in the high-rise developments quite close into the centres of town. So a lot of them were property investors. And quite a few of them, by the way, were overseas investors who bought in, you know, before the latest difficulties.
Prices expected to continue falling in the high-rise sector. The advice remaining, tread cautiously.
I expect to see many more failed settlements ahead. And so in summary, we are seeing pincer movements at work with central banks distorting the financial system and creating pressure on businesses and households as a result. While the COVID crisis continues to rage on, this is going to get plain nasty in the months ahead. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.